A wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him.
Good morning, 10 o'clock. Great to be with you this morning. Can I say, along with Shane, Happy Mother's Day. On behalf of all the children and grandchildren, can I say thank you for all you do and all you have done for your children and for the difference it makes in our lives together. I hope you do get a chance to celebrate today if you are a mum. Maybe you've already had the perfect Mother's Day scene this morning with breakfast in bed and family gathered around, something like this. Of course, you realise that if it's your kids who did make you breakfast, that your kitchen now looks something like this. Maybe your children made you something themselves this year for Mother's Day. Or maybe they just wrapped up something themselves. Whatever's happened this morning, I hope it's a great day. And if it is a great day for you, it's easy to wish that all of our days are like that, that we just string great days all together and life looks like that. But so often our scenes in life don't look like that, do they? For all of us, whether we're a mum or not, things can go wrong, things we do that we wish we hadn't done, things that we can't undo that keep living with us. If we do enjoy celebrations, wouldn't it be great if they lasted forever? And if we don't, if we're not there at the moment, wouldn't it be great to find a way to put the past behind us and to move forward to a better future? Well, you can. Those things are possible. Today, in the time that I have left this morning, I want to show you how. Because today we turn to a part of the Bible with one of the most famous mums of all, Mary, the mother of Jesus. Mary's very famous at Christmas time, of course. Every little girl is at church and in Sunday school wants to be able to play Mary in the Christmas pageant. But you don't see much of Mary as the story of Jesus' adult life unfolds. Here she is, though, in John chapter 2, right at the start of Jesus' public ministry. And this incident that unfolds around her shows us two things about who Jesus is and what he came to do. Two things that affect all of our lives, even us sitting here right here this morning. And so I want to unfold those things for you. And at the end, I'm going to ask you to respond to what it is that I've said this morning with those cards that Shane mentioned earlier on. So if you can find one of those, keep it handy with the pen that hopefully was there on your seat. And we'll get to those a bit later. Let's dive in, though. Two things that we see from this passage. And number one is that Jesus gives joy where there was shame. Jesus gives joy where there was shame. As the sun rises on a new day, Jesus is off to a wedding. He and his disciples, his closest followers, had been invited. It looks like Mary had been invited as well because she's there. And it seems from the invitations, we think that they knew the couple, at least one of the couple, well. So we read in verse 1, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Now, weddings are a big deal, aren't they? They're a big commitment that calls for a big celebration. And on an occasion like that, you want everything to be just right. You don't want anything to go wrong. I'll never forget one of the weddings that I took in one of my first years out of ministry. It was a hot January day. We were in a non-air-conditioned sandstone building at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know those wood-fired kind of ovens? It's kind of a bit like that by about 2 in the afternoon. The groom and the groomsmen were all up the front looking splendid in their three-piece woolen suits. But they were sweating buckets as they were waiting for the bride and her bridesmaids to arrive. And just as the first bridesmaid started walking down the aisle, bang, down went the groomsman standing at the end of the line. Turns out that he had had a dodgy meal the night before. He'd been up all night and he was just too dehydrated to cope with the heat. And so off he went to hospital. And then we started again, one man down. Now, you'd really prefer for stuff like that not to happen on your wedding day. Weddings were a big deal back in the first century as well, when this story takes place. And particularly in this part of the world, celebrations for wedding often lasted a week. Imagine that, 7 days of partying, 7 days of dancing, 7 days of wedding speeches. No, surely not. But it was the groom's responsibility to make sure there was enough food and wine for the whole celebration, for the whole week. And this was a really big deal. There were huge social repercussions for not living up to expectations. And that's what lies behind Mary's raising of the problem. She says, when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They've got no more wine." And this isn't just a passing comment about the catering. Mary brings this to Jesus because the wine running out has serious consequences for this couple and their families in the community that they lived in. Because they lived in a shame culture. So if it had become known that the wine had run out, then both families would have had shame attached to their names for years to come. This new couple would have been known as the ones who ran out of wine, the ones who couldn't get the most special day for their family right, the ones who couldn't be generous enough to provide for all the people who were there. And that kind of shame would have dogged their lives and crushed their joy. Now, maybe there's something that's happened in your life that's brought you shame. Something that somebody did to you. Something that happened that if people found out about, they'd never treat you the same way. Or maybe they have found out about it and they haven't treated you the same way since. Something maybe that's hidden that you've done that if people did find out about, you don't know how you would go on living. Western societies aren't supposed to be shame and honor societies. But I think we know plenty about what it means to be ashamed. But look what happens next. Jesus answers his mum, and at first his answer seems a bit strange. Verse 4, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour, my time has not yet come." His mum asks him for help. And this is how he replies. But you need to read a little bit further into John's gospel to see what Jesus is talking about. You see, over and over again in John's gospel, Jesus refers to his dying on the cross as the hour for which he had come, the time for which he had come. That was the reason that he had been sent into the world by his heavenly Father. That was the ultimate reason that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. As we saw last week, it was he opened up John chapter 1. And so when Mary asks Jesus to get involved and Jesus replies, "My hour has not yet come," he's saying the time hasn't come to yet fully complete his mission. And so instead, he chooses to give a sign of what is to come, a little taste of why he's come to earth. Just incidentally, if there are any young people here this morning or people listening in on the podcast, I don't suggest you try this approach with your own mother. Johnny, can you please tidy your room? Woman, why would you involve me? My hour has not yet come. If you do try this, you may discover that your hour has come faster than you expected. But look what happens next. Verse 6. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill these jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. And then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. And then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Hey, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best until now." Now, someone's done the calculations and worked out that what Jesus produced was about 1,000 bottles of wine. 1,000 bottles of wine. And not just the cheapy stuff. The master of the banquet says, this is the best. So we're talking about top shelf stuff here. 1,000 bottles of premium aged Grange Hermitage. Right? Talk about rescuing the wedding party. But as he did that, he removed their shame. He restored that couple, those families, into relationship with their community. All with a banquet of aged wine. Now, we might well ask what this ancient wedding in the back of nowhere, and Cana in Galilee is the back of nowhere. There's nothing there. This ancient wedding in the back of nowhere with a couple whose names we don't even know, what this has got to do with any of us? Well, it's all in the sign. See, about 800 years before Jesus, a prophet called Isaiah was given a promise from God to give to his people. He spoke words from God. And in Isaiah 25, he gave this promise. He said, "On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken." Isaiah was saying that in the future, God would do something definitive to remove disgrace from his people, to remove shame from his people. And he said, you would know when that day came because it would be a day of celebration. It would be marked by feasting. It would be marked with a banquet of aged wine. And so Jesus rescued this couple and their family from shame by saving their wedding. But at the same time, he showed that that was exactly what he had come to do for everyone. Now, maybe there is something in your life. But whatever it is, God has come to earth himself to deal with it. When Jesus went to the cross, he came to deal with our shame. Where you fear what someone else will think of you, Jesus says, if you trust in me, in my eyes, you are spotless. You are beautiful. It's like you never did that thing, or it was never done to you. Where you fear that someone will get away with something that they have done to you, the cross stands tall as the promise of God's justice and his commitment to setting things right. Which leads to the second thing in this incident that Jesus' life shows us about who he is and what he came to do for us. The first, Jesus gives joy where there was shame. And the second is that Jesus gives celebration where there was guilt. Jesus gives celebration where there was guilt. Now, I think this story in John 2 is pretty well known. Even if you're not a churchgoer, the story of Jesus turning water into wine is kind of part of our language. But it's so easy to miss one of the crucial details which helps us to see what is going on here. And you see it where you look at where the water came from. Look at it again. It's there in verse 6. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars, those jars, with water. So they filled them to the brim. The jars were there for the guests to use for ceremonial washing. Not to clean their hands after their canapes, but to clean themselves before God. Now, what's going on with that? Well, let's go back a step and have a look at this. Have you ever broken the law? Don't put your hands up. That'd be really embarrassing. I mean, I have, actually. I'll never forget the day that I went to buy the engagement ring for my fiancée-to-be. We'd been to the city and we'd been to a jeweler's shop in there that was had the sort of thing that we wanted. And so she just thought maybe one day, someday. So the day came and I thought, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go in and buy that ring. I'm going to do the deed. So I drove to Westmead Station and I parked my car and I got on the train and I went into the city. And I handed over more money than I'd handed over anything up to that point in my life at all. As I got back on the train, kind of dazed and kind of excited all at once, got back to Westmead, I went to the car and there I found the dreaded brown envelope sitting under the windscreen wiper. See, it turns out that I had parked illegally and that I had to pay a fine. And so that day ended up being one of the most expensive days of my life. She was worth every cent though. You see, I had broken the law. The law says that there is a right place where you can park your car and there is a wrong place where you had parked your car. It's very clear. There are signs. There are rules. If you break the rules, then you're guilty and there is a punishment to pay. In this case, thankfully, it was just a fine. But I was guilty. I'd done the wrong thing and I had to pay the penalty. Now, it's the same with God. There's a right way to live in response to the fact that he's God and he made us. And there's a wrong way. Jesus himself told us that the right way is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And to love your neighbor as yourself. That's the right way to live in response to who God is. In fact, God had been saying that for a long time before Jesus. He said it in all sorts of different ways throughout the Old Testament. And he said, look, I know you guys, speaking to his people there, he said, I know you guys, you're going to get this wrong. I know you're going to break my laws. So if you want to be right with me, here's a way that you can get the penalty done away with. You need to be washed from guilt. And there's a number of different ways that you can do it. But one of the ways is to do ceremonial washing. That's one of the ways that God said, if you do the wrong thing, you can have your guilt removed. You need to wash. And the washing of yourself symbolizes a bigger washing with me, the washing away of your guilt before God. But you had to do that kind of washing all the time, and in a special way. You even had to do it when you went to weddings, like this one here in Cana. That's what the jars are doing there. And the fact that you had to do it all the time was a reminder that you kind of really couldn't escape the guilt. But Jesus points to a new day in what he does. He says, fill those ceremonial washing jars to the brim. And now watch what I do. That water that you used to wash yourself clean with God, you don't need that anymore. You don't need it because something better is here. Something more final is here. And it's me and what I'm about to do. He says, my blood on the cross will wash you clean from any guilt that you have before God, from all of the times that you've lived as though God didn't exist or as though God didn't matter. You will be washed clean, says Jesus. And so what you will need is not this water in the jars anymore. Once you realize that truth, that I have come to deal with your guilt once and for all, you're not going to need that water anymore. You're going to need something to party with. You're going to need something to celebrate with. You will need party drink. And so here, have a banquet of aged wine. Because you see, when you've escaped a guilty verdict and escaped the penalty that a guilty verdict attracts, it is a cause for celebration. It does bring joy. I don't know whether you saw recently some of that footage on the news of that Channel 9 crew from 60 Minutes who'd gone over to Lebanon and that kind of botched case of trying to snatch some children and bring them back to Australia. Regardless of what you think of that whole thing, if you saw that footage of them arriving back at the airport, then you saw a picture of pure joy and celebration because those people thought that they were going to be found guilty. Those people thought that they were facing the penalty for breaking the law. But instead, they had had an innocent verdict proclaimed on them, and the faces showed what that is like to be freed from that guilt. That's what Jesus has come to bring each and every one of us for eternity when we realize that he came to wash us clean from guilt before him because he died where we should have died to take the penalty that we should have got when he went to the cross. And he rose again to declare us innocent. Jesus gives celebration where there was guilt. Which brings me to my final words this morning. We have seen his glory. Will you trust him? We've seen his glory. Will you trust him? John, the gospel writer, finishes off the account of this incident in verse 11. He says, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. What we see is that when those first followers of Jesus worked out who he was and what he had come to do, they couldn't be passive. They couldn't just stand there and go, oh, that's nice for them. What a lovely story that will make for their kids. Hey, kids, guess what happened at our wedding? No, these events, this person demanded a response. What they had seen him do was nothing less than a sign of heaven meeting earth, of God himself arriving to bring in a new day. This Jesus they had seen was the glory of God himself standing before them, showing them reality and offering them a new life. And their response, we read, was to believe in him. To believe in him. Now, belief nowadays is a pretty soft kind of word, I think. You can believe in something. And people will think that means that you think something is maybe kind of true. Or if you believe in something, it's kind of like you wish it was true, but you can't really know. But that's not what the word means here. It's actually not what the word means in the Bible at all. No, when it says that the disciples believed in him, it means that they trusted him with their lives. It's the kind of belief you have when you lie on the operating table and just before they put you under, you look one last time at the surgeon who's holding the knife and hopefully smiling underneath that mask. And you think back to all the certificates you saw on her wall and all the times she spoke to you reassuringly, nodding her head, "Yes, I do know what I'm doing. Yes, this is the best thing for you." That's what it means to believe. Not to just say, "I reckon you probably could do that." It's to say, "You can do that, and I'm going to lie on the table so you can." That's the sort of belief that Jesus calls for from us. He says, if you put your trust in me, if you put your life in my hands, you can know joy where there was shame. You can know celebration where there was guilt. You can know life with God starting now and lasting for eternity, a feast of wines and meats, a banquet of aged wine where death has been swallowed up forever and there is only joy. And so, I want to give you a chance right here this morning. If you've never taken that step to put your life in his hands, I want to give you a chance to do that here this morning. In a moment, I'm going to pray a prayer line by line and see if you want to pray it, you can echo it in your mind. But first, let me read it out for you so there's no surprises here. This is what the prayer says. It says, "Dear God, thank you that you sent Jesus to die on the cross in my place. Please forgive me for all the times I've lived as though you didn't exist or didn't matter. Thank you that Jesus brings joy where there was shame and celebration where there was guilt. Please help me to live trusting in Jesus. Amen." That's the prayer. Now, if you've never prayed that prayer before, I'm going to give you a chance to pray it now and to cross over from death to life in God's eyes. So I'm going to ask everyone in the room now, whether you want to pray the prayer or not, there's no pressure on you, it's only if you want to do that. But if I'm going to ask everybody if they would mind just bowing their heads and closing their eyes right now. And I'm going to pray this prayer line by line. And if you want to pray it, then just echo the words in your mind and God will hear you. So let's do that now. Dear God, thank you that you sent Jesus to die on the cross in my place. Please forgive me for all the times I have lived as though you didn't exist or didn't matter. Thank you that Jesus brings joy where there was shame and celebration where there was guilt. Please help me to live trusting in Jesus. Amen.